You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The leaders of the world's richest economies have gathered in L'Aquila, Italy, to discuss the pressing issues they all face as a result of the recent economic meltdown. Joining me now for an analysis of what's happened during the first half of the G8 summit and what we might expect on the final day is John Peet, the European editor of The Economist. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. The group of 20 met in London back in April. How did the group of 8 meetings differ from the G20, other than the fact that there are 12 fewer representatives there?
Well, you might think that 12 fewer means it's easier to have a discussion, and in some ways it is. I mean, the G8, of course, began as a sort of fireside discussion of leaders, but they then have invited quite a lot of other people to be nearby, including leaders from countries like India, Brazil, and China. And then the president of China has actually had to go back to China. So in some ways, I think the G8 has outlived its day. The G20 is actually more important for tackling issues relating to the world economy and climate change than the G8 is.
Well, as you point out, Chinese President Hu Jintao had to go back to China because of the violence in Xinjiang province. But since China plays such an important role in the global economy, does his absence mean that anything that's agreed to will have much force?
I mean, I think you could regard all these meetings as sort of progress of one sort or another. I mean, the idea that international leaders in a time of economic crisis and great worry about the future of the climate should meet regularly is a good one. But I think it would be hard to say that the G8 is the critical forum in which decisions are going to be taken. We know that on the climate, the Copenhagen summit later this year is the important meeting.
Is this laying groundwork for Copenhagen?
Well, I think they've made a bit more progress. I mean, clearly there's a way to go. People from Europe are obviously feeling that they've done quite a lot, and they're looking for more from both the United States and from China and India. And I think this meeting, I think it'd be hard to say this meeting's gone backwards, but I don't think it's made a huge step forward. But the pressure to do more to about climate change is clearly still there.
Well, yesterday the focus seemed to be on climate change, and they announced an agreement for industrialized nations to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050, all nations to reduce them by 50%. That is a major change to what was already agreed to, isn't it?
It is clearly a big step forward in terms of the goal.
But no details on how those goals will be achieved?
That's the problem. You know, we had a meeting in Heiligendamm, Germany, last year, at which people signed up to various goals, and President Bush was regarded by the others as not being very helpful on that, but he did sign up to a goal. Now, clearly, President Obama and the others have signed up to more ambitious goals, but, I mean, 2050 is a long way off, and the real test is how do you get there? How do you meet these goals? What kind of measures are you willing to put in place? What kind of taxes are you willing to impose to achieve these goals? And there's still a long way from agreeing on all those intermediate steps.
Has there been any progress in bridging the divide between the industrialized and developing nations when it comes to curbing emissions?
I would say there's still a long way to go on that. And that's the particular area where discussing these things in the G8 group is probably not the right answer, because you start with a position where China and India, which are obviously absolutely critical on climate change, that they're not full members of the G8. They are invited, but they're sort of kept in a back room, as it were. Whereas at the G20, and then again at Copenhagen, the Copenhagen summit due in December, they will be full members. And you clearly have to persuade the Chinese and Indians to sign up to something if you're going to have a meaningful program for tackling climate change. But each meeting is making some progress towards persuading them that it's in their interest as well as in the interests of rich countries.
Hasn't the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon already criticized the agreement that they reached yesterday?
It is this age-old problem. If it's fine, you can sign up to quite ambitious-looking goals, but you haven't actually set out the path that you're going to take to meet those goals. And there's been some criticism, for example, of the United States climate change legislation for not being tough enough, and there's uncertainty about whether it'll go through the Senate. So every country has its own problems, and I think it's reasonable for people to keep criticizing world leaders for not doing enough on this one, just as it is on what what to do about the world economy. There wasn't really much of a strong agreement on how to revive the world economy yesterday. And I think that those sort of things do raise questions about the usefulness of the G8 itself.
Well, it's one thing for these leaders to come to agreements. It's another thing for their governments to come to agreements. In the democracies, they have to get their parliaments or their congresses to go along with them. And we saw that with Kyoto in the United States and any number of other agreements that have been reached. This would not be any exception, would it?
No, it certainly would not. And I'd have to say that the U.S. is in some ways the particular problem there. I mean, in most of the other Western countries, if the head of government says, I agree to do something, they usually have sufficient control of their legislatures to be able to achieve that goal. It's not been easy, even in a country like Germany, to do that. But the U.S. is clearly a particular problem on that, because the administration will have difficulty getting any agreement through Congress. And as you say, we saw that with Kyoto. We may well see that with anything that's agreed at the Copenhagen meeting later in the year. So everybody knows that you can't push this too far.
On the other hand, the U.S. is saying that the House's vote on climate change is evidence of a U.S. commitment to dealing with the problem.
It is clearly evidence of a substantial move in the United States, and we've seen before that a substantial move at state level in the United States with places like California taking this issue very seriously. But I mean, the Europeans have tended to be ahead on this subject. And I think when it comes to worries about getting legislation through the Senate, they are very concerned that what goes through the Senate would not be tough enough to really substantially reduce emissions in the United States. That is a general worry around the world.
There's been complaints about the lack of leadership from the Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi in the preparations for the summit. What hasn't he done that the host country usually does?
I think they're a bit unfair. I mean, actually, we at The Economist have long criticized Berlusconi, and we don't think he's a very good prime minister. But I don't actually think this summit has been badly organized or badly handled. I mean, it was a slight grandstanding decision to move it to L'Aquila because of the earthquake. But the meeting hasn't been at all bad. I mean, the objections to Berlusconi don't really relate to his handling of the summit. I mean, he has had a lot of distractions because of various scandals recently. And he's not doing enough to reform his country, which is going through really quite serious economic problems. But I don't think his handling of the summit has been exceptionally bad. It's just that this group of people don't represent enough of the world now to be able to sort of take measures and to agree measures on either the economy or the environment or overseas aid when they only represent less than half the world's GDP.
Now, there was some controversy over his moving the summit to L'Aquila, which was hit by that earthquake that killed 300 people. Has hosting it distract the rebuilding efforts, or has it highlighted them? I mean, we're talking about a city that's still geologically active. There was a 4.1 aftershock on Friday.
There was indeed. I mean, that has been a concern. I think it's slightly focused more attention on the need to rebuild after the earthquake. I mean, it was not by any means the world's worst earthquake, but by Western European standards, it was a bad earthquake. And I don't think the Italian government has been bad about taking measures to rebuild afterwards. And it seems to me this is a reasonable gesture, if you are the host of the summit, to move the summit to that location, to focus attention on these sort of things.
It's often pointed out that much of the work of these summits actually occurs before the heads of state even sit down. Have we had any sense as to whether someone has taken the lead in the discussion so far?
I would have to say that I think, I mean, it's not quite a criticism of the Italians, but it's quite clear that the United States and the White House have actually played a very strong role in relation to this summit. I mean, it's the first G8 summit that Obama has attended, of course, but it's also because much of the agenda was a focus on things like the economic problems of the world, climate change, and so on, has been one where people have been looking to the United States and President Obama to take a lead, and they've clearly been very energetic in doing that, I think to some effect.
Today, the bilateral meetings are taking place with countries not in the G8, Brazil, China, India, Mexico, South Africa, Egypt. What kinds of issues are discussed in these sessions? Is the agenda pretty much the same thing that the G8 discusses when it's alone?
I think it is pretty much the same thing. I mean, the obviously the overwhelming problem for all countries is what to do about the world economy and how to get it moving, how to get banks lending again, how to pull out of recession. That's the biggest problem. And the second problem probably is what to do about the climate. And then the third problem in relation to some of these countries is how to persuade rich countries in these hard times to stick to their commitments towards foreign aid. And there, I think the Italian hosts have been rather bad, because their record on foreign aid has not been a good one.
I'm talking with John Peet, a European editor of The Economist, about the G8 summit in L'Aquila, Italy. They talked about Iran, but they ignored the recent elections. They just talked about nuclear issues.
That's right. It's not necessarily a good environment for discussing political issues. I mean, one of the problems with the G8, of course, is that Russia is a full member. And although Russia shares the general goal with Western countries of not wanting to see a nuclear Iran, they don't have the same interests as the West in relation to bringing democracy to Iran. And they've made it very clear that they value stability there more than anything else. Russia has different interests in Iran from the West. And it's not surprising that means that discussing Iran is not really a very fruitful subject at a meeting like the G8.
Well, in the past, during the Cold War, the West put missiles on Iranian soil aimed at the Soviet Union, so I suspect they remember that.
It's a very near neighbor. I mean, Russia obviously is very concerned about Iran because it's right next to them.
Have the leaders talked about the global recession much yet, or is that an issue that sort of hangs out over everything that they're doing?
In a way, it hangs over everything. They did have some discussion yesterday. There is a difference of view, which we saw also at the G20 summit in London, and we may see again in Pittsburgh later in the year when the G20 meets again. The British and Americans are tending towards the view that the more spending governments can do to get economies moving, the better, whereas the Germans and, to a lesser extent, French, are tending to say, we've done enough. We want to wait and see what will happen, and we're a little bit worried that if we spend too much, we might ignite inflation. So I wouldn't say there's a complete meeting of minds on this subject, but clearly what to do about the world economy and what to do to get banks moving, and later what to do about things like regulation and improving the governance of the international monetary system, are very, very important subjects that hang over almost everything else they talk about.
But do we have to have international agreement? As you point out, Angela Merkel especially has been very consistent in pushing back on further stimulus spending. If she doesn't want Germany to do it, why should the United States worry about that?
I mean, the answer to that is, you know, you can't force another country to spend money. But if your conclusion is that there is a really serious risk of deflation and inadequate demand, then it's much better to persuade all countries to administer fiscal stimulus together. If only one country does it, that means that, you know, the you get less bang for your buck, as it were. And I think that was a lot of the discussion that was going on in London in April, which wasn't conclusive. Most countries have now done quite a lot of stimulus to try and pep up their economies, but I don't think there's going to be much of an agreement to do more. And the United States and Britain in particular are now heading for really substantial budget deficits, which means that their scope for doing more is much more limited.
Well, how important is this politically for some of the leaders who are facing elections, like Gordon Brown and Angela Merkel?
I think it's less of a concern for Angela Merkel, because I would expect her to remain as chancellor even after the election, partly because her opposition is weak and divided. Gordon Brown is frankly a weakened leader already, and everybody knows that he's likely to lose the election next year, whatever happens. So the politics vary from one country to another. But I think it'd be fair to say that the strongest leaders around are the strongest leader around is clearly Barack Obama himself, having won an election quite recently, and with his party in control of both houses of Congress.
Although polls are starting to turn against him a little bit in this country, that may change if the economy improves. Former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan wrote a letter to Silvio Berlusconi asking that Italy increase its aid to Africa. Is that development and humanitarian aid still a major part of the agenda this week? Because it's not just Italy, it's also Italy and France who've fallen behind in their aid schedules.
I mean, It has been part of the agenda ever since the Gleneagles G8 summit 4 years ago, when Tony Blair was the host, and they put the issue of development and aid, particularly for Africa, very high up the agenda, and he invited a number of African leaders. And the rich countries did make certain commitments about raising the levels of foreign aid, which some countries, including Britain, have largely delivered. But it is perfectly fair for Kofi Annan to point the finger at Italy as the worst offender in refusing to raise its foreign aid budget. And one or two other countries, including France, have not been very, very good either.
But Italy has a serious problem with its economy. Can it even afford to start sending aid to Africa?
Well, that's what I was about to say. I mean, of course, you can make these commitments, and in principle, countries do think that it's a good idea to help help the poorest countries. But at times like these, clearly, people are going to find it harder than before to fulfill those commitments. I mean, I think what Kofi Annan and others are trying to do is to persuade people that even in hard times, they should try and stick to their commitments, because hard times are even worse for countries in Africa and the poorer countries in the world. But it's not always easy to persuade people that it's a good idea when you have troubles at home to send money abroad.
Food security is another major theme at the meeting. And yesterday, President Obama asked the G8 countries to give $15 billion over 3 years in aid to poor farmers. Is that a program that is likely to move forward?
I think there's a general concern about food security, and we saw what happened particularly to food prices in the past sort of two to three years that brought home to some countries that might not have thought about this that food security is not something they should take for granted, that prices can go up, that demand from China in particular is likely to have an effect on the price of foodstuffs. I am doubtful about whether anybody will be prepared to commit substantial sums of money towards improving food security. But there does seem to be the beginnings of a consensus that it would be a good idea to put more money into research to improve food yields. I mean, back in the 1960s, we had a very strong development of the Green Revolution, which raised food yields everywhere. And there is a feeling out there that that's stopped and that it would be worth continuing to do research in order to raise food yields, particularly in developing countries.
It's stopped mostly in Africa, where the problem is gravest at this moment. For all sorts of reasons, it just hasn't moved to Africa. The World Bank would play a pivotal role in getting that aid distributed. Do they have any say in what goes on at this G8 summit?
I mean, they're there. You know, the IMF and the World Bank are both represented. And of course, development is part of the agenda through the aid program. I just don't think that this is right at the top of most leaders' agenda right now. And it's something that if we are concerned about increasingly looking ahead, institutions like the World Bank are going to have to bang the drum quite loudly and say, remember to do something about food security and developing stronger yields and better yields in Africa. Because just now, as you said, the attention is on the economy, on other issues like climate change, so people aren't really sort of thinking about this subject very much.
How does the G8 summit relate to the Doha round of trade talks being conducted by the World Trade Organization?
Well, once again, you get, you know, leaders meeting rather as they did when they first met in the G20 in Washington back in November, and saying, we now insist that we want to complete the Doha round. And it would be a good idea to keep going on the process of trade liberalization and to try to complete that Doha round of international trade talks. But it's been going for a very long time. And we've seen time and again world leaders saying we want to complete this round. And then when the details are on the table of what tariffs you should cut, what kind of market opening you should agree, what you should do about reducing subsidies to farmers, the trade ministers and the agriculture ministers fail to reach an agreement. I think it would be very optimistic for anybody to say that there is a good prospect of completing the Doha round in the next year. We've just not seen enough progress and enough evidence that governments are committed to doing that.
As long as they can't agree on cotton and sugar, for example.
That's
what
right.
Can we expect in the final day of the summit?
I wouldn't look for very much, frankly. I mean, you know, it would be nice if they made a slightly more concrete commitment on foreign aid to restate the goal of Gleneagles. And it would be good if they come out in their communique with at least some language on completing the Doha round of trade talks that might give it an extra push. But I don't think you're going to see a great deal more from the summit than we've seen already.
John Peet is the European editor of The Economist. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.